Welcome to the Own Your Choices, Own Your Life podcast. I know you are here wanting to change and rewrite your story. You are desiring to step into the impact that you know you are here to create. I am here to guide you with the proven tools and strategies used by myself and our speakers to support you in taking radical responsibility in your life and learning how to own your choices to change your story. My name is Marcia Van Weinsberg. I am a storytelling business coach, master NLP trainer, speaker, podcaster, and 7 times published author. My clients have found freedom and purpose from overcoming their shame stories and learning how to share them with the world. I am so grateful you are here. Let's get started. Welcome back to the show. Today we are speaking with John A. Brink. John is a CEO and he is here to share his story with us today. John was born in 1940 in Nazi-occupied Holland during the Second World War. From the time he could walk, his days often consisted of foraging for food with his brother and sister during harsh, warlike conditions, surrounded by death and hardship, especially during the hungry winter of 1944 to 45. John's mother was left to raise her 3 kids alone when their father was drafted into the Dutch army. They wouldn't know if he was dead or alive until the liberation of their village by Canadian soldiers on April 12, 1945. This was the exact moment when John determined he would one day move to Canada, the land of his heroes. He was only 5 years old when this decision was rendered. Like many others who lived through that time, John has lived his entire life with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, resulting from being in a war zone. After serving in the Dutch Air Force for 2 years, John subsequently emigrated to Canada in July 1965, arriving in Prince George with $25.47 in his pocket. John's other lifelong dream of owning a sawmill came to fruition 10 years later in 1975 with the creation of Brink Forest Products, which has since become North America's leading secondary manufacturer of value-added wood products. At 83 years old, John continues to succeed in his role as president and CEO of the Brink Group of Companies and 10 plus other companies. John is the author of 3 books and the host of the On the Brink podcast series, which I was grateful to be a guest on the show. He is also a fierce advocate for erasing the stigma around ADHD, something John has lived with his entire life. In his spare time, John enjoys riding, dressage, bodybuilding, philanthropy, writing, public speaking, and spending time with his family, wife, and animals. In recognition of John's lifelong achievements, he was awarded an honorary doctorate of law degree by the University of Northern British Columbia. This is a man with so much expertise, experience, knowledge, and he comes in today sharing it all with you. We dive into what does inner child healing look like, how it took decades to learn what this was, and how powerful this work had been for John in impacting him in his life. We dive into the topics of PTSD, ADHD, and the power of using our voices to share and heal our stories. And when we do, we learn how connected we are all from our stories. John shares his journey as a published author, a health enthusiast, and his upcoming goals for his health in his 84th year, which are absolutely incredible. And I have no doubt that he will do it. You have to follow along his Instagram as he shares his work and what he's doing in the gym, in his health, his priority. I love this episode. You're going to love it. Welcome to the show today, John. I am so grateful to have you here with us.
Well, thank you, Marcia. Be glad to be there.
So you and I had a conversation a few months back on your show, and I just absolutely love the connection and conversation. So I knew without a shadow of a doubt that you would be somebody I wanted to be able to bring here to share with my audience. So there's a lot of things that we talk about, and you have so much wisdom and knowledge that I know I really want to share with everyone. I want to take it back to, where did John start? What was your early years like? I know what they were like, but I would love for you to share it with the audience.
So sure, Masha. Like we had our podcast, as you said, a couple of months ago, On the Brink. And so which was very interesting. And podcasting is so interesting now, just starting really, and including the world all around us, and interesting individuals, obviously. So I'm 83 years old. Was born November the 1st, 1940, in Eastern Holland, and close to the border with Germany. And for all the people watching, already kind of figured out that was the start of World War II. My dad was drafted into the Dutch Army April the 1st, 1940. And the last they heard from him is when he got a message from him from Rotterdam that was bombed, the center of Rotterdam, to push the Dutch into giving up against the German war. And so thousands and thousands of people died, and it destroyed the center of a big, big city in Rotterdam. Then my mom had, at that point, she had a daughter and a son that were 1 year and 2 years old, and I was then born November the 1st. So she would be alone for the next 5 years during the war years, and I still, even at my age then, at 3.5, 4 years old, I remember the sound of bombers overhead and of the Allied forces bombing Germany to defeat them in the war, as they came from Normandy through the west coast of Holland, and at the same time by air bombed all the cities that were critical to them, that were making war. And again, if you kind of visualize Holland, the northeastern corner was close to the North Sea axis, and then same for Germany, they were bordering at the North Sea by Hamburg, Bremen, Wilhelmshaven, Kiel. All those key cities were all just across the border from us. And I still remember, from 1943 forward, you had daytime, nighttime bombing, and my mother would take us outside. We had a flat roof behind our house, a deck on the house, to look at all those hundreds of planes. It was not to watch them, but it was safer for her to be outside than inside. And, and the sound of hundreds of bombers, still a sound that even at that age, will never forget. And then in the distance, we saw cities burning. The skies would be red, and bombers would come back, and there was all kinds of other issues that happened then. And then the next thing that happened is in the winter of 1944, 1945, it was called the Hunger Winter in Holland. That was the coldest on record. And at the same time, what the Germans had done is cut off all the food supply to most of Holland. And again, a lot of young people died, a lot of older people died that were vulnerable, and thousands of them. And then the other part that is still part of me and that I remember is it was cold, really cold, the coldest winter on record, as I said. And then at the same time, for my sister and my brother would together go, and I was then 4.5, 5 years old, and they were 1 year older than me. My sister 1 year old, my brother 2 years old. We would take gunny sacks and go into the railroad yards and pick up anything edible and burnable. And the reason that we did is because the Germans wouldn't shoot us, but the Buddhists wanted the next day we'd be back. And but even now still, Masha, I can feel the feeling of hunger. Now nearly 79, 80 years later, I can still feel that. And then the feeling of cold, because at the house we didn't have any fuel to burn and our regular heating system. So we had a little room that was heated, and anything that was burnable, we put in there, and we'd be sitting around that, to try to stay warm. But even now, still, I can feel the immense cold.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were liberated by the Canadian Army April the 12th, 1945. Saw far too much that we should not have seen, dead bodies, people being shot, and especially where we were, and again, visualized Northern Holland, in the northwestern part of, in the northeastern part of Holland, just before you go across the border with Germany. And as the Allied forces and the Canadians came in through Normandy and then through the west coast of Holland, pushed them through the top of Holland back to Germany, everybody was pretty desperate, and the Germans were as well, blew up all the bridges behind them to slow down the Allied forces, and including a bridge right in front of our house that I still remember, having pillows on my head, being in the basement or underneath the floor, so it was pretty rough going. But the other part about it is that liberated by the Canadian Army, April the 12th, 1945, by the Canadians, it left such an impression on me, the liberators, that I always knew from that point forward, I wanted to go to the land of my heroes, Canada. And I tried to go when I was 17, and my parents wouldn't let me then. Then I was drafted in the Dutch Air Force for 24 to 30 months. And then finally, I left Holland when I was 23. And then the other part with me is I was not very successful academically. I failed grade 3, and I failed grade 7 three times. And then my parents said, well, they were beautiful people. And then people said to them, Bob, what are you going to do with this guy? And should we send him to the mentally challenged school, or should we try to get him a job of some sort? So my dad was involved in the lumber industry, managed a little lumber company, and then my grandfather was a master carpenter, so that was a good idea. So they sent me to a furniture factory, and at 13, and then in the evening I would go to the school to get a career and becoming a furniture maker, and then during the daytime I worked in the factory. And the interesting part about that is also that kids can be hard on each other, right? So the guys that and girls that I grew up with that had been my friends would go on to college and university, where in my case, I became a laborer, and it was looked down on. I'm proud of that today, but then It wasn't very good. And I kind of had felt that I failed. And although I was always optimistic and always had a positive mind in a way, but in myself, I felt I had failed. And I knew that I could do just as well as the others. And so going to Canada became even more important for me to not only was it my dream, but also to start anew from a totally new beginning. And to test myself if I could do it on my own, starting with nothing. Couldn't speak the language, didn't know a soul, didn't have any family there. And that became important to me. And then I knew, a little bit radical, I would not go back to Holland unless it was in a box or successful. A little bit radical, but that's kind of the way I felt about it. So when I arrived here in Canada, flew into Montreal and then the train across Canada. That's a long way, 4 days, 5 nights.
Very long way.
And so when I arrived in Vancouver, I went to the immigration office, and fortunately there was, I could speak English, obviously, but there was a German fellow. I could speak some German. And I told him what I wanted to do. He said, go to Prince George. And that's a boom town. That's lots of timber there and blah, blah, blah. And that's where they're building sawmills, pulp mills, and all the other things. And so that's what I wanted to do. And so I stepped the bus, and then 12, 14 hours later, I was in Prince George. Now, for all the people watching us from around the world, is that Prince George, British Columbia, Canada, is a big province, a beautiful province, lots of timber, and Vancouver, most people are familiar with, and Victoria. But Prince George is in the center of British Columbia, north to south, east to west, and it's about 800 kilometers north of Vancouver. And, beautiful, beautiful area. So when I arrived in here in Prince George, and, from the bus, I had my suitcase, my two sets of clothes, three books, and then I counted my money at least three times, and I had $25.47.
Well, this.
But I did have plenty of his attitude. No matter what happens, if it is a tough day tomorrow, I swear it's going to be a better day tomorrow. And then I had passion. Whatever I do, I give it 150%. And then the third one is work ethic. I work harder than anybody. And if you apply these, this became the foundation of my life. Attitude, passion, work ethic, but will follow is success. So with the 25.47, obviously I had to kind of find a job very, very quickly. And by coincidence, I found a job as a cleanup person, then became a lumber pilot. And then within a year and a half, I was the superintendent of one of the largest sawmills here. And within 2.25 years, I was part owner of a little sawmill in Watson Lake, Yukon. That is another, there I go, 800 kilometers north of Vancouver. Now I had to go 1,600 kilometers north in the Yukon Territory. That is right next to Alaska for the people watching us. I always say about the Yukon, I was there for about 5 years, and it snows in July, and you don't know if it is late or early, and that kind of a place. And for a guy coming from Holland, the coldest I have seen there was 62 below zero.
Oh, okay. So we're at like minus 32 Celsius below zero. So minus six, I can't imagine.
It's dangerous, and then to keep things going, keep your house warm and all those kind of things. It is dangerous, dangerous, but it was not uncommon in those areas. Anyway, I was there for 5 years and then went back to Prince George, gave it all away actually at one for the one. This is a different story, but started all over again and came back to Prince George, worked for the mill. And then within 5 years thereafter, after I'd been here for 10 years in 1975, started a company called Brink Forest Products that became part of the Brink Group of companies. Today, it's not a hoorah, hoorah. I'm not here to tell you about how successful I am. I'm telling you simply that I started a company, and then now we have about 10 companies, fairly successful. And and then some other things happened that changed my life, really, that I believe are important in terms of I still, even then, still felt, although people said, oh, you're so successful and blah, blah, blah. I didn't feel that way.
I actually wanted to go here because I think this is a big part of your story. If I can ask one question, I do want to come back to this, is like, I can see it. Obviously, work ethic makes complete sense to me because of you. That was very instilled from a young age. Like you would have had to. Passion, I can see. Attitude. If you think back, were you always somebody who had a really positive attitude? I mean, it'd be easy not to, considering what you grew up watching and seeing. Is that something you always had, or was that something that you found a way to have?
Good question, Marcia. It's something, and that obviously crossed my mind over the years. I always had that, even when during the war years, when I was this little boy, 5 years old and trying to survive. I lived in a world of my own a lot of times. And the reason that I did is because I heard always negative, negative, negative. And even that to today that sometimes happen, I avoid negative. I'm a positive thinker. And now when I'm a public speaker, I'm writing books and I do podcasting, I always say, positive attitude is the foundation. You must be at peace with who you are and what you are.
And I would just want anybody who's listening to really let that last sentence land, like be at peace with who you are and what you are. Because no matter what circumstance you come from, having a good attitude, a positive attitude, it is foundational, and it's a choice. You could have easily had a very negative, I mean, and honestly, rightfully so. Like, I mean, you saw things that most of us could never even imagine. And you saw it firsthand. So I know that this kind of, I'm guessing, this leads into this part of your story as you're talking about, like that you had these levels of success. One of the things that we had such a beautiful conversation about that I did not know we'd go that way is this piece of recognizing how inner child healing and how we're holding on to trauma for decades until we actually do the work. So we can have all of this external success where most people are like, wow, you've got it all figured out. But inside, internally, we're like, I don't feel like I do. And so what was that? What led to that for you? And then what work did you dive into?
So PTSD became part of who I am and was as a result of what we saw in the circumstances that I grew up in, seeing far too much. And that's what I say now in particular, with all the things that are going on around the world, Central Europe, obviously, it was the Ukraine, and then the Middle East, and then seeing all those things that will have an effect. It's not what people sometimes think, that it's war and now the war is over and everything goes back to normal. No, it likely will not for a generation. It may even take more than one generation. It will never likely go back to what we knew. It doesn't. Anyway, so then PTSD would become part of my life, mm-hmm. and still is today. And then the other part that was very much part of my life, and actually, at some point when in my marriage or relationship that I had at the time, is that we needed some counseling. And as we did successfully, actually, the counselor, I still admire him for what he did. He said to us, I want to talk to John on his own about other things.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, in particular about the inner child. And even now, this is obvious, still affects me. It took me till I was well into my 50s to get counseling. Very emotional, but very important. So where did it come from? It is likely, again, as I said earlier, my dad was drafted into the Dutch army, didn't see him for 5 years. And it is the fear of these little kids of losing the only person that was there.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it came from, fearing losing my mother, because then there'd be no one. Because everybody had the same problems. It was not a question of, okay, then the neighbor can look after you, or the family. Well, everybody had their own issues. So it became a question of if you would lose her, then you'd be on your own. And that stayed with me and till it was recognized by that person as a kind of was part of the issues that were unresolved, mm-hmm. even well into my, probably by that time I would have been in my mid to late 50s.
And I'm just like, I appreciate you so much sharing what you're sharing and for sharing this part of it, because there's so many things that are happening right now as you're sharing this. I mean, as I listened to your story in the beginning, I did many times I thought of your mom and I thought like the pressure that she must have gone through to try and keep it together. And really, she could be on her own permanently at that point, not knowing. And you know, there's more parts to your story there. So I could almost relate and connect with your mom and just in a sense of imagine what that must have felt like. And then the fear from your space as a child of like, what happens if something happens to my mom? Like, then it embeds this fear into our subconscious of like, I don't want to lose somebody.
Yeah. And then the other part that we were well aware of, you know, being even that young, and I sometimes look at it, I look at my grandchildren that are in that age and I say, you know, and how smart they are even at 4 or 5 years old. And I say, yeah, now I can see where, you know, this was not just I'm sucking on a bottle and I don't know what's going on around me. No, no, it's far different than that. Even at that age, you're well aware. And then seeing the things around you, if it is hundreds and hundreds of planes, I mean, 200, 300 bombers in the air, the sound of that is unbelievable. Seeing in the distance, cities burning, the sky be red in a distance, you know, the from where the bombs fell. And then the other part is that when the Canadian Army came in, you know, pursuing the Germans, and I always want to make sure we were all victims, including the Germans, you know, so it's not the bad Germans, or they were victims as well, as we see now in the Ukraine and we see in Russia, where they are attacking the Ukraine. The Russians themselves, it's their leadership, the dictators, same in Iran, same in North Korea, same in Venezuela, Cuba, go on and on and on. And then say how fortunate we are. It's not a perfect system being a democratic country. The alternative is worse. For those that don't believe it can be, and it can change very, very quickly. But anyway, as kids then seeing that part of the bombing, and then the other part is that, you know, seeing, you know, hand-to-hand fighting virtually, you know, and seeing one of our neighbors got shot, got shot, got a bullet right through the head. We saw that hanging out of the front window. And then people got shot on the way out. The bridge blew up. Then there was a period of no man's land where the Germans had blown up the bridge and there was some distance between them and the Canadians. And then the underground picked up the collaborators and would either cut their hair off for the women and then or shot the man right in front of the canal and dump them into the canal and be there picking up the bullets, you know, so or the empties. So all that kind of stuff, it's or seeing carts with legs hanging out, arms, all that kind of stuff stays with you, even at 5 years old, you know.
It's, and if I can just share for the listeners, that our subconscious mind, like, is literally our body. And what happens is that's where we store, like, we store all of those emotions and experiences and thoughts, and we don't even realize they're so ingrained. And the most, how do I say this? What emphasizes them being anchored in our system is what do we see, what do we hear, what do we feel? And so as I didn't experience anything like you experienced, but as you were explaining, you know, seeing hundreds of bombers going over, I can imagine hearing it, seeing it, feeling it. And so all of those stressors are anchoring in your system. And so this is the case when we talk about inner child healing and releasing PTSD and understanding what it's doing to our body. It is incredibly powerful, the experiences that we experienced up until the age of 7 and 8 years old. And for some of us, I mean, we had nothing even remotely like that, but it still anchors in our system. So I appreciate you sharing the way that you are, because I've never interviewed anybody who has experienced this on this level. So now you're in your mid to late 50s and you're doing work on yourself. You have a very good therapist who recognizes that, wait, this is actually something that we need to, you know, we need to address. What was that experience like for you, and how did that create change in your life?
So we agreed, with now my wife, but, that we should do that. Very, very emotional, Marcia. And I had no idea of the inner child, never even heard of it, So, but it's that little boy in my case that never reconciled, right?
Yep. And so heard, right? Never heard. Yeah.
Yeah. It liberated me from that.
Mm-hmm.
But a little kid and inside, so that's, it's very, very important. But extremely emotional, and it's all part of it. But the reason that I mention it is, as you already noticed, that very emotional to me, even today, but it's important for me to talk about it, because if I don't, who would otherwise, and who would have, that opportunity to share it with so many individuals that are watching us from around the world? It is it's not nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, to the contrary, and because it is directly related to trauma, and that all people handle trauma in different ways, and that may well be whatever it is, and so many people are affected by trauma, and I'm not sure if we are dealing with that, with all of that, as effective as we can, and recognizing it, and more it will come to the surface and affect people in all kinds of different ways, where I believe we can invest more in stress that results from trauma and I'm not an expert. I'm simply an example that can say that on the foundation, it's not that fellow that saw too much and got affected by it, or was not successful in schools because of. So in my case, between the inner child, PTSD, the other one that we'll probably talk about, I, and just mentioning it right up front already, I'm ADHD, attention deficit disorder, and a good example of that, that I found out about that when in 1997, when I found a book in a store driven to distraction. I opened the book and it's about ADHD. I said, oh my God, that's me. So, and I've since talked about that, and I have written about that, and I feel again that the combination of all of it, I've seen the trauma, I've seen war, I've seen the results of it, like the inner child, PTSD, in a combination. I'm not saying that flows from it. I believe ADHD, I was born to be ADHD, but I was not born with the inner child. That circumstances, trauma directly, indirectly, resulting from war or situations that people are involved in, is something that we can deal with and should be dealing and do more about. But the whole combination of all the above, it gave me the underlying strength to start over again from the ground up, because I had no peace in me. I knew I was as good as the others, not better than, but as good as, and I had to reconcile that. I went to the other side of the world and started with nothing. And obviously I wrote books about it, and I exposed myself to a lot of hardship that may not, and I'm saying that in a positive way. I'm not sure that everybody could have done that, because it involved a lot of things that put me even to the edge of where I could go physically, mentally, and all the other things, but I stayed the course. And then obviously became, from a business perspective, successful. But the other part about it is I have an obligation to talk about it.
You know, you're speaking my words right now. I'm so grateful that you said that, because one of my questions for you was going to be that you come from a generation, I come from a generation where it's not okay to share personal things. It's not okay to talk about things that are difficult. And it's very much was frowned upon for a long time that you can't do that. You can't share things like that. And I deep down believe, I actually have said the word obligation, and I don't mean it in a martyr way. I believe that when you find a way through a difficult circumstance and you find something that is a solution base that helped you through something, I believe we're obligated to share it and to support others with it. And I feel like that's what you're doing. Have you ever felt or received pushback of that's sharing too much? That's oversharing. We shouldn't do that. That's not okay to do that. Or have you always been supported in sharing your story in the way that you are?
Yeah, that's a good question, Marcia. I don't think I've ever been pushed back, but in all fairness, you know, like as I said earlier, when I discovered I had ADHD, that was in 1997 when I found a book that was written by Dr. Hollywell in 1993, actually, and I got it in 1997. I opened it and it said ADHD, and I said, oh my God, that's me. Now, the interesting part about it is you may find interesting. I had Dr. Hollywell on my, he's written about 18 books or so. He's a worldwide special individual, a doctorate, a PhD, you name it. He has it, ADHD. And, you know, and he was on my podcast last week.
I love that. What was that like for you to be able to interview him? Because that must have been quite an experience.
You should see the podcast. Which one is it, Scott, again? 201? I believe it's 201 podcast. Okay. You have to watch it.
I will watch it.
And I say that also to your young guest. You know, it is an amazing podcast. The question is, yes, but somewhat emotional to me. Not quite like, you know, that, you know, today the questions were quite emotional. But emotional to me, it changed my life. You know, so there's no question about it. That part, knowing that I'm ADHD, that changed my life. There's no question about it. But happened before that, probably because of some of the things that I did not have peace of mind and still felt I had been a failure. I was never a good communicator. I'd be okay in my environment, my operations here, and talk to three or four people. And then in 1990, my ex-sister-in-law dragged me to a place, and I probably told you that before, called Toastmasters.
Yes.
And I said, but why? What are you doing there? She said, you know, it's good for you. But I had difficulty interacting and communicating. And I said, are you going to ask me things? And I said, you just sit there and you watch. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll go down there. So I went down there, and then somebody stood up and said, hey, John, tell us about you. I said, oh, my God, I'll never go back here. You know, but I did. I stayed there for 10 years and I became a distinguished Toastmaster. And that's the highest level you can get in Toastmasters. I'm now a keynote presenter all over the place. And obviously, I'm very active in podcasting, doing all this. There's other things. So between the combination of going to Canada, starting my own mill, then the key things that unlock things for me was going to Toastmasters in 1990 and becoming a better communicator for 10 years. And to put that into perspective, probably 450,000 people are active in Toastmasters around North America, also Europe, and go to different levels inside of Toastmasters. Probably 10 million at some point were part of it. Not everybody goes to the level that I did. Less than 1% of them go to the level of being a distinguished Toastmaster. Doesn't mean that the others have not gained from it. But for me, it was so critically important that I stayed there for 10 years and went through the top. So if I look back, the things that changed me is that finding Toastmasters for 10 years from 1990 to 2000 changed my world. Then in 1997, when I found a book from Dr. Hollywell, you know, Driven to Distraction about ADHD, it took me 5 years before when I was 62 years old, I went to my doc, but was a personal friend, delivered our two daughters, that I walked into his office and I said, he said, why are you here, John? I said, I think I got ADHD. And so we looked at it. Yeah, I do. And so the combination of all of that, you know, going to Toastmasters, but having living the experience for one of all these years, then, you know, going to Toastmasters, then, you know, ADHD and knowing that part. Then from there on in, I became more vocal about it. I started thinking about it. Now, over the years, people had said to me, you have to write a book about it. And so I tried to do that for about 20 years. I stopped, as you well know, because you're an author as well.
Yeah.
You stopped, and I did that. And then I knew 5-6 years ago, if I don't do it now, it will never happen. So I wrote a book, Against All Odds.
Mm.
And it's not about hoorah, hoorah, how successful John is. No, it's just about the opposite, all the ups and downs along the way. I send them to you, all three of the books, actually. And yeah. So you've seen them. So then when I did that, and the more I started reconciling really what ADHD means, when I found out initially I was ashamed of it, because there I'm a guy building lumber companies and go to the banks and making proposals and want to lend from them millions of dollars to build infrastructure. And what am I going to say? I got a mental disease as well. It's called ADHD. They would sort of have a nice day, right? So not now so much anymore. There's still some tick stigma. So I believe that, and Dr. Halliwell agrees with me, that 8% of the population, I always thought, and many other people did too, that are affected, male and female, are affected by ADHD. Him and me, we both agreed that it is in excess of 20%. I usually say, he said it's probably in excess of 50%.
Wow.
The other part that you will find interesting about it, I've said this, and sometimes being controversial about it in a sense, that I said of the successful is the operative here, entrepreneurs, that likely 50% of them are ADHD. Dr. Halliwell says, no, John, 75%, he believes. So
I wonder, yeah. So what does this, so 75% of successful entrepreneurs being ADHD, what is it about ADHD and successful entrepreneurs that go together that support that number?
Thinking outside of the box.
I knew yours. I love that.
They have the opportunity. Most people say it in the box. They become extremely uncomfortable when you wander outside the box. I live there. You know, and for me, in fact, we hired, we're looking for a successful senior person in our operation. So we advertised all over the place and we put in the advertisement, ADHD considered to be an asset.
I love that you did that. I love that you did that. That's beautiful.
So that's the key to it. And so I wrote a book about that, you know, so because then the more I included it in my presentation, the more I felt I had to write a book about it. ADHD Unlocked is the book. And so that came out last July. And then the other part that, you know, that so many people don't like what they are doing. This goes to attitude, passion, work ethic. They don't like what they're doing. They say, I hate my job, you know. So say, well, change. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, well, I got my kids are going this and blah, blah, blah. And say, if you do something that you do not like, you take it home with you.
Everywhere.
Change your life, you know. So. And then to younger people, I say that, you know, that I do a lot of presenting to is, what do you want to do for a career? And saying, well, I don't know. I said, well, check it out. You want to be a welder, you want to be a truck driver, you want to be a lawyer, you want to be an accountant, you want to be a CEO, whatever you want to do, make contact with people that do those kind of jobs. And then it gives you an idea about what it involves. Most of them will be quite prepared to talk to you about it, you know, so I wrote a book about that as well. So, because I believe it is so important. So finding your passion, mm-hmm. living the dream. And then a fair question would be, say, okay, John, are you living the dream? I am, you know, I still at 83, get up at 5:30 in the morning and then I always think I'm late and I always make my bed. And then every day, usually have a positive attitude when I get there and then give it all that I got. And that's kind of what I do.
And, yeah, and I, You embody that. I see it in your videos. I see it in things that you share. Like, your goal is to go into your 84th year as strong as you could possibly go, right? Is that what you, did I see that?
Yeah. Absolutely. And then the other one that I'm working on that's coming out this July is that I'm also very much into healthy living, healthy diets, and it takes a trigger. I nearly died in 2008 of a case called diverticulitis. And then I knew I had to do something about that. I came that close, actually, of ruptured and not good.
Yeah.
And so I then started to take it much more serious. My wife is vegan, and I used to be 80-20 pretty much, but reluctantly. But then I knew I had to change. Mm-hmm. I did. And then the other part that I did is going to the gym. I hired a trainer, and then after doing that for 6, 7, 8 years, in 2017, 18, somebody walked up to me and they say, there was about 7, 8 years into that in 2007, 2008, 2016 or so, whenever it was. Somebody came up to me and said, have you ever thought about competing? I said, me? And so I then started looking at competing. And I said, why not? So I did. And then 2017, I competed here in Northern BC. I came in second in bodybuilding, third in physique. And my 55 years and older, I already was in my 70s. The competition could have been my kids, you know. And that I qualified then for the provincials. I did that. And then I came in third in physique, second in bodybuilding there. That qualified me for the Nationals and the Arnolds. And then obviously COVID came. And then now I'm training again for hopefully getting again to the Nationals and the Arnolds in 2025, when I'm in my 85th year. And I think I'm the oldest competitive bodybuilding in North America. So I wrote a book about that, Living Young, Dying Old. And this one is coming out in July. Oh.
I cannot wait to share that one. Look at that. If you're not watching the video, he's ripped. I love it. This is probably another reason why I've always connected to you and your story. My husband is an Olympic lifter and he qualified. He won nationals this year and he's qualified to go to worlds this year. And it's so funny because people will say, you know, or it's just hard or all the reasons, whatever. And I'm like, he works really hard. Like, he works very, very hard, but it's part of our life. It's not like, let's do this for 10 weeks and see what happens. It's literally part of our life, from food to workout to time and all the things. And I love it. Like, it's amazing how many, if I just plug them for a second, how many younger, I say, like, people 20, 30 years younger than him they're mesmerized. They just can't believe it. And it's like, but he does so much, as you would too. It's not just about the time in the gym. It's not just about that. It's all encompassing, right? It's all encompassing.
And the people that competitive with do, and I'm not saying everybody should, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, but the ones that do all belong there because it's part of their life, not only their life, they need to have that team around them, like you supporting your husband and the kids likely and everybody, because it takes a lot for him to get to that level, as it does anytime I'm in the provincials, in particular, and going to the national level. Everybody that is there belongs there, and an amazing sport. On the other hand, I want to hasten to suggest that especially in my book, Living Young, Dying Old, everybody does not have to necessarily get to this, but at least stay active physically. Mm-hmm. And even if you walk just a half an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour a day, it's all it takes. If you enjoy going beyond that, whatever it is, triathlon or marathons or whatever, or bodybuilding for that matter, whatever it is, then that is great. But stay physically fit, and then watch your diet. And I do a lot of the shopping for myself, for my wife, who's vegan, actually. I do the shopping. because I always stay on the outside of the store, mainly plant-based diet we have. Mm-hmm. I stay away from the center aisles, which is mainly processed food, and we don't want that.
I love that you said that, and I can't wait to share your book out, and I love everything that you're doing.
Now, you've seen my book. I'm going to show you one more thing. On the back of the book, I don't know if you can see the price of the book.
Yeah, 25. I can't remember what it came through. Yeah.
25.47?
Yeah. Oh, 25.47.
You're making the connection?
Of course I am. Yeah. That's what you came to Canada with when you got to Prince George, was 25.47. Yeah,
exactly.
I love that. You're an incredible soul, and I'm beyond grateful that our paths have crossed. I think there's just a lot of things about what you do that I love. I love how much you openly talk about healing and what it's done for you and, you know, making yourself a priority. I just want to ask, like, if you look at John from 30 years ago before you really dove into this work to now, how has the quality of your life changed because of it?
I always kind of think about it, what changed my life is that coming to Canada, I had the foundation, attitude, passion, work ethic, but I did not have is the critically important tools of being at peace with who I was and feeling confident that I had not failed, that I was as good as everybody else was, and I was going to prove that to me. So what changed me was 1990, so that's when I was 50, when I started going to Toastmasters and liking it. I knew very quickly that what was lacking for me before is not having confidence. This allowed me on the road to confidence. The other one was that was major in my life in 1997, when I picked up the book, Driven to Distraction. I was 57 years old then. That in combination with Toastmasters changed my life because that gave me the key to knowing that I'm an ADHD person. That's who I am. I was born that way. But it's, and I want to stress that again, and I say it many, many times, as you watch Dr. Halliwell and myself and 201, my podcast, it's a superpower. That's what it is. ADHD is the term attention deficit disorder. He says, and I agree with them, is not representative. It implies or may imply a shortcoming of some sort. It isn't. It's just the other way. So what I do is I use it in combination with it's a superpower. Once you know that you have it, and especially to younger people, unlock the potential of it. Think about that box. Most people are in the box. You know, they go to university and with all due respect, and they get these degrees and they learn to think inside the box. And not, now the interesting part about me is that I have a doctorate of laws from the University of Northern British Columbia, an honorary one, but I deserve it.
You know, I saw that. That's amazing. That's awesome.
So what I'm saying is that if you have ADHD, think about it. It's a superpower. It opens immense opportunities. And then interact with others, read not only my book, other books, and find out. That to me was also a key, is the three books. Yeah, would be a fair question if you asked me, what were the three books that you had with you when you came to Canada and your two sets of clothes and your 2547? Is that the books were Management by Drucker and Dutch.
I don't know that one.
Yeah. Very interesting, very well known in terms of management tools that Drucker was very, very progressive in terms of management. And then the other one is Logical Thinking in Dutch. And then the other one was about Canada.
Wow. Yeah, I love how you shared that. And I thank you for that in the sense that there was a time when ADHD carried a lot of shame with it. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, no shame. It's my superpower. It's who I am. It's what I do. It's like part of me. It's part of my business, part of my life. And there is no shame with it. And so I think any part of our story can become that, right? It starts as a shame piece. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, this is not a shame piece. This is who I am. This is like part of my story. I'm not afraid to share it. So I love that you do that. I love everything that you're doing and the impact that you're continuing to make. And I will make sure everything is in the show notes. Where's the best place for people to connect and follow and learn more about you?
JohnABrink.com would be one. And then we are on all major avenues virtually in regards to our book sales on Amazon and all across the board. And then our podcasts are On the Brink. And the podcasting that I do go right across the board from one extreme to the other. And I love doing that. And they are, I'm more than anything, Marcia, and you've known me now through two podcasts, I'm a storyteller.
I know.
That's who I am. And so if I do podcasting, it all comes from the heart and it all comes spontaneously. And that's kind of what I do.
Yeah, I can tell. And I knew from that very first conversation you and I had, because I very much connect to stories. It's always been something I've connected to. And it's typically what I do is sharing parts of those stories, because that's what people see. They get a chance to see themselves in your story and connect to you. And I guarantee you, there's somebody today who had a different switch go off to recognize that maybe something they were feeling shame about in their story is actually a superpower. And it is a superpower. I have always embraced, I say always, there was a period of time where I didn't, but vulnerability, like allowing myself to be seen. And for the longest time was told, it's too much. You shouldn't do that. That's not safe. And I know that that's a superpower now. And I own that. And I'm grateful for that because it allows me to connect with people that I wouldn't otherwise connect with.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so... In my case, it took so long. It was not until I was 62 that I knew I was then diagnosed, you know, that I had ADHD. But mm-hmm. to recognize that as a superpower took me some time. And then once I did, I say, how unfortunate, because all that period before that, from the time that I was really 13, 14 and was not successful, obviously, in our traditional learning system, it should have been known that it needed special attention. And it put question in my mind of failure that should not have been there. It was just the opposite. It was unlocking that potential. And if I can help doing that through my books, my podcast, and my interaction, then that to me is very important. And if I do that and can do that, and I'm now at the point where I'm at peace with who I am, then by sharing it and having it help some people, then I believe I've been successful.
Mm-hmm. You have. Absolutely have. I guarantee it. I have loved this conversation, John. I have one more question for you, and it is, what lesson in life are you most grateful for?
Always staying the course, I think, and not giving up and being determined. You know, that every so often, not very often, but it's seldom that I feel depressed a little bit, and then I talk to myself about that, not very often, because that doesn't happen very often, but I always look at the positive, and I always try, and then I don't carry baggage, you know, because especially not negative, people that I think should have supported didn't, and I will forgive them and just go on with life and just put it behind me, because I don't have enough time. And it's not very helpful. I go forward. And I look forward and saying, where am I going to be next year, the following year, and on and on and on. I want to go back to the Arnolds. I want to write another book. I love doing podcasting and interacting, action, you know, and podcasting is an amazing media, you know, like if I do speaking circuit and do keynotes and all kinds of places, then it usually takes me 2 days to do a keynote, and I don't have time. To me, it's precious at my age, obviously. And I find that podcasting, and especially using PodMatch, has become an amazing media that is still at the beginning. Yesterday, I did a podcast with a fellow in Budapest, Hungary. Amazing.
Oh.
What's the one? 2003? 205. 205. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah. Amazing podcast. Amazing.
I say that it's brought the most incredible people into my life. Like, I've literally met some of the most. I got a message the other day from somebody who heard a podcast of mine from almost 3 years ago. And they said, I was listening to this. I'm thinking in my head, when was that from? Like, am I having to really think about it? And she told me the number. It was like 200 and something. I'm on 650 now. And it was from 3 years ago. And she said, I'm from Belgium. I'm diving into all your content. I absolutely love it. Like, where else am I going to connect with somebody from? This is the beautiful thing of podcasting. It really is.
And that's the point, right? So it's an amazing media because there you and me are sitting here talking. And although you're in Canada and Eastern Canada, you know, but you and me are sitting, you know, on each on a different side of Canada. And it feels like we're sitting together. We already developed this friendship between you and me. And at the same time, when we are doing this, we know that thousands of people, we know that already, are watching from either side because you will share it with your guest and your people on your podcasting. I will do the same with mine. And all of a sudden, our story becomes important to all of them. Where else can you have that possibly like that? And they are timeless in the other sense, because what we are talking about is as much, if not more relevant next year than it is even this year and beyond.
Yeah, it's content that lives on. It lives on. That's why I'm saying when this person messaged me, I'm thinking 3 years ago, like what's the, we talk about, it's important to be part of social media. I understand that. But it has a life, right? Social media only has a certain life. Podcast has like endless life. It can just float around and people find it. So I am grateful for our connection. I'm very, like, I look forward to your new book. I'm always inspired by what you're sharing, what you're doing. And I'm grateful that I've had the opportunity to share you with my audience today, John.
And the feeling is mutual, Marcia. And let's make sure we stay in touch.
I would love that. I would absolutely love that.
Take care.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Own Your Choices, Own Your Life. If you love this episode, I invite you to tag me on social media with your takeaways or share it with a friend. Please, if you feel called, take 30 seconds to leave a 5-star review and I will be forever grateful. Until next time, remember, when you own your choices, you truly own your life.